It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Hi, Jason Howell. I'm taking over the show for the second of 3 weeks, and we have a lot of fun. We've got Jeff Jarvis, of course, who joins us for most of the show. We've got Kevin Marks, also Ron Richards, my cohort from All About Android. We're going to talk all about next week's hardware event, Andromeda. We've got some Twitter talk on who might buy them, maybe Google. Snapchat's spectacles are pretty crazy, and we talk all about that and more coming up next on This Week in Google.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly, CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 372, recorded on Wednesday, September 28th, 2016. Fail Whale on Ice. This episode of This Week in Google is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Go to ring.com/twig and get up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit with their limited time offer. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Twig, This Week in Google. It's my honor to be here, Jason Howell, filling in for Leo Laporte while he is still gallivanting around the world, as far as I know. This is my second of 3 weeks in a row that I will be happy to be on set here to talk all things Google. We might get a little bit into the cloud, into some of the social network stuff that's happening out there. But we've got a lot of Google news today, so I think it'll be pretty easy to stay on point for the most part. Joining me today is my cohort and friend, Ron Richards. Of course, we do a show every single week together.
We gallivant across the Android ecosystem every week.
That's right. With All About Android, it's always awesome to get to podcast with you. I get that that honor every single week, and now I get it a couple of times, so that's great.
Yeah, and I like to talk about a little more general stuff on this show as well, too, so that's good.
For sure. And also joining us is Kevin Marks, who, I mean, when I was producing behind the scenes for Leo, you know, communicated a lot with Kevin to kind of get the show going, but I've never actually done a show with you. So it's really nice to do that.
That's great. That's great to see you and be able to do that.
Yeah. Yes, I really do appreciate it. KevinMarks.com. And yeah, we got a lot to talk about. and I don't know if we jump right into the event, because I feel like that's where we started last week, because we're like firmly in the rumor world leading up to Google's hardware event next week. Before we kind of talk about this, I know how Ron feels about kind of what we've learned kind of getting closer to this event. Kevin, I'm curious, are you anticipating what Google has in store for us next week? Do you think it's going to be a really big deal?
I haven't been following it super closely. I'm assuming it's basically a refresh of the line. But the piece that I'm kind of intrigued about is what they're doing to support the VR stuff and what they're doing in terms of hardware and particularly camera hardware around that. And I haven't seen much discussion of that so far.
Yeah, I mean, we know that, you know, on the underlying OS on Nougat, there is Daydream VR. Google announced that at I/O this last summer. And then it's kind of been pretty silent on that, mainly because even when they announced it at Google I/O, they said, you know, all this stuff is going to happen sometime in the fall. And that's kind of where we're at now. And the event lines up with that. So, I mean, if you're excited about the VR stuff, I have a very good feeling that we're going to see at least a decent amount of information revealed at the event next week. What excites you about kind of the VR aspect of Android right now?
Well, part of it is more sort of what that implies for the device. So my assumption is that they're going to start moving cameras around on the device to make it more plausible as an AR headset as well. Mm-hmm. So if you take the six that I've got here, actually I'll take it out of its case. So this, what I'm talking about is slightly more obvious, so it's still stickery. This has a lens at one end. Mm-hmm. It would be very natural to put another lens at the other end, and suddenly then when it's in the viewer, you're able to do overlay much, much more easily. You've got the stereoscopic thing naturally there. Mm. So that's one thought. It's like if you put a second camera there, that would be the thing. The other thing to think about would be if you align this camera with the camera, the camera on the other side, which is currently offset a bit, that would let you do the spherical VR stuff fairly easily as well. So, in the same way that Apple has been showing off what you can do with two lenses, and we've seen there are a couple of Android devices that have done that too, if you think about where you place them, you could make a very straightforward both stereoscopic capture device if you have those two and spherical capture device if you had these two. So I'm not sure if they've been thinking that, but it makes sense to me given the direction they've been talking about with VR and AR. And it maybe that doesn't quite make it into this cycle round, but it's the natural sort of tendency to add more and more cameras and microphones to these devices. That's only going to grow over time because it makes more and more sense about what you can do with them.
For sure. And I feel like the trend, oh, hello. Where did you come from, Mr. Jeff Jarvis?
I'm playing hooky. I'm running microphone. I'm playing hooky. I'm running an all-day event here with audience development people from media, but this is important to me, so I'm running out to do the podcast for a while, and then I'll sneak away again, but I can't miss you guys. I missed two weeks recently, and that's a sin. So.
Oh, well, it's great to have you.
You're stuck with
here.
Me. I'm here. It's great to be here.
Excellent. I'm happy that you've chosen to play hooky. If only for an hour, we'll take you for as long as you can stick around, and we'll do the really kind of juicy nuggets up at the top so you can be involved with all this stuff. We're just kind of talking a little bit about kind of Google's VR virtual reality, augmented reality ambitions and how much we actually expect to see out of the event coming up. Google has this Daydream spec, and you know, we've heard a little bit about that, basically, you know, geared towards getting hardware developers to create headsets that'll work with Daydream that's built into Android underneath. And that has certain hardware requirements. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard much about kind of the dual camera kind of stereoscopic stuff, if at all, right now. But I could totally see that being part of the plan in the longer term as they try and kind of fill out the feature set for VR specifically. That would be cool.
Yeah, I think going off what Kevin was just saying, I think I'm more interested in starting with 180 than 360. I don't think you need the both. I think that's possible. And I think even, you know, I keep on plugging. I have no interest in this, but I keep on plugging the amazing Mevo camera that Leo also has.
Right.
It shoots at 150 at 4K, which enables you to get, and it recognizes faces. So it can get, it's like having a four-camera shoot. If you have a 180 and people can pick perspective on that, I think that's interesting, and it can work in most any format. And if a phone can do 150 or 180, that opens up a lot of opportunities. I think it's what the new LG, I think, has a 180. One of the cameras is advertising the fact that you can go to 180 now.
Makes sense. Well, sort of what I'm implying with this is that, you know, I've said if you add the two either side, then you've got a stereoscopic thing. You could do the full depth thing. If you put the front and back one, you can have effectively a 180 on one side and 180 on the other and do the stitching. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And each 180 has a value beyond...
Yes.
You know, a 90 degree.
Yeah.
That'd be a cool way to fill it out.
And I feel like if Google's going to do something in VR, it's got to be something that no one else is really doing. It's got to be something that's a little different, their own take on it. And I think that, you know, laid the groundwork with the Daydream spec at I.O. in May, and this is real now going to be the consumer payoff, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. So Google has already kind of started to set the wheels in motion for content and getting developers on board. They actually just a few days ago took the Google VR SDK out of beta. There are a bunch of developers that Google has relationships with that are currently working on this, obviously. And I have a really good feeling if and when they show this off at the event next week, you know, not only are we going to see at least some compatible hardware, not only are we going to see Google's latest crop of Pixel phones probably compatible with the Daydream spec, but we'll also, I would hope anyways, they would demonstrate a little bit of what developers have been able to do with their partnerships to create and bring these immersive experiences to Android VR to give it, you know, to Daydream VR to give it some reason to actually exist. Because, I mean, that's the question. Is how necessary is this that it's being built into Android directly? I'm excited for it, though. I've got Gear VR at home, and I show it to people. You know, people come over, and they see that thing. They're like, oh, is that virtual reality? You know, they've never done it before. Go ahead and put them in, like, a roller coaster thing or, you know, something fun. And, I mean, it's really cool to see what it does for them. It's just translating that into the everyday person, like how do you get them excited without having a headset to put on every single person's head? I don't know how that translates.
Well, that's something that we Jason, you and I talked about this I think last week with the Samsung ads that have been running for Gear VR, which are shooting people using Gear VR, so you don't see what they're seeing in the visor, but you're seeing their reaction to it. And I think that's a way of humanizing the experience, that because really VR is a hard thing to sell. And it looks like Samsung has figured out a neat way to do it. I'm curious, especially with this event, you know, being so hyped up to be the big consumer event, what Google's angle on selling VR to their customers will be.
Yeah. So what do you think, that, given that it's supposed to be VR and phone and home and assistant?
It's everything.
Yeah. You know, what do you think their killer is going to be in that? It, knowing what we know, what do you think the biggest priority is? The most oomph?
Oh man, that's a really challenging.
And let me add in that I mean, if you haven't talked about it already, we'll talk about the next Pixel, the Pixel 3. I'm disconsolate that we may have to wait a year for a new Pixel.
I figured that might not be something you were too excited about, but it's nice to know there's something on the horizon.
Well, we think.
Yeah, we think anyways. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I am personally, ever since, and we have not talked about it on the show yet, so we might as well bring it up now. It's what you're talking about is something called Andromeda. There have been multiple leaks to Android Police as well as to 9to5 Google, who are basically saying there is a new OS, and we've heard this off and on for the past however many years. Wall Street Journal teased this last year, a full year ago, saying that sometime this year there would be a new OS at least unveiled, and the following year it would be released in some sort of commercial product that combines Android and Chrome OS officially. I think when we saw at Google I.O. that Android apps were coming into Chrome OS, we thought, oh, maybe this is what they were talking about. And, you know, Google or Alphabet had changed, you know, its direction, its course on that. But it turns out Andromeda, which is this OS, is expected to launch sometime, I think it's Q3 of next year, on what would be the next Pixel, the Pixel 3.
It's supposedly being tested quietly on a Nexus 9 or maybe the new Nexus 7.
Yeah.
What I've said is this is not Android being added to Chrome. It's the opposite. From what I've read, the rumor is that it's Chrome being added to Android.
Exactly.
And that Android becomes the base. So is in your prognostication, do you think this is a third operating system, or does this eventually, in fact, replace the other two?
I have a hard time believing that Google, I mean, granted, they have two OSs right now. They have Android for mobile, and then they have Chrome OS for their like laptop effort or whatever. I have a hard time thinking that Google would concurrently create an Android that is not including this extra stuff, and then mm-hmm. a version of mm-hmm. Android that mm-hmm. does include this extra stuff.
Good point.
I think if they're going to do this, I think it becomes the next phase of Android, essentially, and it becomes Android that includes all the great things of Chrome OS for whatever form factor. I mean, this Pixel 3, they're not targeting this at the audience. You know, it's supposed to be a convertible tablet, let's say. They're not targeting at users of, you know, high-end tablets. Their purpose, based on some of these leaks, is to target MacBook Pro users, that level of users. So what they're really creating here, if you think about that, is an actual laptop, desktop style.
Well, and also the Surface too, right? Wouldn't it compete with that?
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it would have stylus support. So Wacom tablet support in there. It sounds really compelling.
But a year is a long time to wait. Jeez.
Yeah. So there's that. And then also,
I don't, you know, with this event and this news coming up, I don't want to see them say, you know, and we've got this great new thing that's coming in a year from now. The whole point of this is to get people excited.
They don't want to say that. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I hope that they do show it off. Some of the rumors are pointing to this Huawei 7-inch tablet as being number one, it would be a Nexus. So we're wondering if Pixel replaces Nexus. It turns out, based on these leaks, that Nexus would still exist. It would still be the developer-focused kind of arm of Google's hardware efforts. And that this tablet would, in fact, be a Nexus because whether it hits developers' hands immediately after the event or, you know, with Nougat or with Andromeda, at some point it is expected to get Andromeda and be kind of like the test base piece of hardware so that developers can get on board and learn the lessons they need to learn to prepare for the official launch.
So in this world where you have, is it possible to imagine in 2 years that every laptop will there be such thing as a laptop? Will everything be convertible? And B, will they all have to have touch?
That's a good question. What do you guys think?
Because the idea of a Chromebook without touch becomes absurd. once you have Android added in.
Yeah, I agree. I would not buy a Chrome OS laptop right now if it did not have touch, because the enticing quality of it beyond just being Chrome OS now is access to millions of Android apps, and those it's are like infinitely better if you have touch versus not. But I
don't know. It's been, you know, I consider myself to be on the cutting edge, and I can't give up a physical keyboard on my laptop. I don't know why.
I agree with that. I agree with that, Ron. I absolutely agree with that. But if you start to combine the two worlds, you know, right here is my Pixel C, right? And I'm that's the only thing I travel with now. It's because it has a keyboard.
Right.
Because the keyboard is so wonderfully integrated, and by the way, trickle charges, so I don't have to charge the damn thing. And so it's just a separable laptop.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you, Ron.
Which is what Microsoft has been saying for several years as well. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And in effect, Apple is with the iPad Pro, where the keyboard is kind of part of the experience. Mm-hmm. So we are seeing that convergence between the two. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But with Android, we're going to get all the variations because it's Android. It's not like, you know, Google will make a set of product choices, but then there's several other players who make different sets of choices. So the space will get explored one way or the other.
Yeah,
I'm still waiting for one of those experimental projection keyboards that I can just carry a tablet and it'll just have the little light touch where I can just tap on a desktop and it knows what I'm typing.
Oh man!
You know what I want? What was it? Captain Queeg had the balls, right? What I want is a one hand typing device.
Yeah. Just like all the controls in like a handheld one device. Hand. Like,
I keep on trying to think. So how many knuckles do you have? You know, could it be that if you touched your fingers at various knuckles? I don't know.
Well, that was fun. What was it called? There was a British one from like 20 years ago that you could do that with.
Wasn't there?
A little cord keyboard thing. It had three different things that you held and you would press them. So there were multiple buttons per finger, and there was one you could hold down with your thumb as a shift. And so that would let you do the letters.
I mean, I'm
trying to remember whether it was cool, but it was a huge thing for a while before, you know, keyboards got more portable.
That would allow you to compute on two different machines at once. probably take some mental gymnastics to pull that off, but
well, the other half of this is, you know, maybe it ties back to the VR thing and the data gloves and so on. Is that the problem with cardboard to date has been the 3D has been, it's, you know, yes, it's cheesier than the full immersion ones, but it kind of works. But the interaction has been look in the right direction and press one button, and the one button is poking the screen randomly, and that so it's. Up to now, that has been lacking. So I'm wondering if we'll get any hint of better user experience stuff for that at this event as well.
Yeah, I mean, part of the Daydream spec involves a controller, a handheld controller.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it's
more of like a little remote control than it is like a full-fledged, like two hands on a controller sort of thing. But that opens up the play field a little bit, let's say. You know, the cardboard, it was always kind of the lower end VR by design, but you had to hold it to your face. It's got the single button as part of the, you know, embedded in the piece of cardboard, and it's very limiting, like you say. When I first got the Gear VR, I was like, you can mount it to your head, but how much is that really going to expand beyond what I've, you know, played with many times with Google Cardboard? And, you know, it turns out from a comfort standpoint, you know, that really goes a long way to being immersive. You're not holding a piece of cardboard to your face. You're putting this thing on your head and then forgetting about it and letting yourself be immersed in this world. Control is still a tap on the side, but once you can pull your hands down and have it on a device that deals with that specifically, then that helps even further with that immersion.
Well, I mean, that's everybody with all these VR systems, hasn't it? It's been how do you get a representation of your hands into the world effectively?
Yeah, right.
I was at some conference last week. I can't even remember what conference it was. I go to too many. But it's not VR. It's not AR. It's now MR. Modified reality.
Oh, magically. Okay.
Right. So that you're not so much having to immerse yourself in a world, but that you can augment a world in a way that the world seems real to you. That this is not a water bottle. This is an imaginary object I'm picking up. That changes the idea of having to be in this closed, dark thing. As opposed to you're still open, but you're involved in a new world, which is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. So that's basically HoloLens, right? That's what Microsoft is doing. I mean, that's augmented or manufactured reality, right? Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that's what I was saying. But that's why you need the thing with two cameras in it so that you can have a stereo view to feed to you.
That would be nice. Some sort of a stereo pass-through feed would be really nice. So we've got those on board. We've heard that the Google Home, kind of the home appliance, Google's home appliance that looks like an air freshener, is rumored to cost around $130. Well, it's $129, I think, is the rumor, which I think comes in at about the cost I was hoping for. I wasn't sure if it was going to be more expensive than that. I thought, I was thinking, eh, I could see it at like $150 or whatever. Is that inexpensive enough, do you think, based on the features that it has, for it to be a very popular, I don't know, holiday season thing?
That's a great price point, especially if you're shopping and you're looking at the Amazon Echo and you're looking at Google Home and you see the price difference between. And I know that the Amazon Echo Tap, the little hockey puck one, is cheaper, but you know the Amazon Echo, the cylinder, is what the, you know, kind of what everybody's going for. And with this being cheaper than that, that's exactly who they need to undercut, because they need to steal as much market share away from Amazon Echo to make this thing work. Mm-hmm. This is the one I'm most excited about to see on shelves in houses. I want to get it in my house. I want to see how it works. So I can't wait to see. Wait, can't wait to get my hands on it. I want an on sale date.
You don't need to get your hands on it. Use your voice, Ron.
Well, it needs to be here first.
Well, so here's a question about this. John Keefe, who's at WNYC, who's helping us out at CUNY and some things, a wonderful tinker, a maker, put Alexa software on a Raspberry Pi. And it works just like it. The only thing you can't do is the only thing you can speak to is official Amazon products. You have to touch it. Is Google going to make Home Assistant? I'm going to guess that Google's not going to tie it to its hardware, but that Google is going to put out an API so that you can talk to Google through the same way you talk to Assistant on your phone, on any device, right? Does that kind of break the necessity of buying an Alexa? This is just a demonstration model. Wouldn't Google be more motivated, you think, to put a stronger API?
Yeah, that seems more googly. I mean, but also it's closer, you know, what it's close to what they're doing anyway. If you think about what's already there in Android for voice search, then this is just pulling that out of the Android and putting it on the desktop, whereas Amazon had to build a thing from scratch to do that.
Yeah, that's true. And prove that it had a market for it too, which it has done well.
And it's also a different set of context. You know, Amazon has one set of context for you, but it's mainly a shopping context, and theirs will probably work well in that. Whereas Google has a bunch of other contexts, which was they showed off in the demo video for it and so on. And the challenge is going to be, how do you make that work when there's more than one person in the household, and how do you not leak context too much?
That, I think, is the big challenge. And for all of these things, and mind you, I don't have an Amazon Echo, but I have to imagine if you are in a house and you have a device like this and it has all sorts of, like, it excels in the world of context, let's say. That's how it's most beneficial as a utility, is if it gains all this information about you as a user and it can surface those things in useful ways. But if there's no way to check identity, I mean, you know, I could have a Google Home in my house, in our house, and I have at least two users, myself and my wife, who could benefit from this. But if it launches the way they said it was going to at Google I.O. with support for one account, then it becomes far less useful.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's so true. Yeah.
Because if you go back to the Google I.O. demo video, you had a family of four all talking to it, saying, turn on the music in Sarah's room and turn the TV on in the living room. And the kid was asking it questions. Ideally, I imagine there's got to be some sort of voice recognition or pattern sequencing matching that they're going to have embedded into it. And you know, unfortunately, now I'm worried about it after your comments, Jason, because after seeing the announcements from Google I.O. and then the launch of Google Duo and the launch of Google Allo, I wonder if Google's getting back to releasing not quite ready for primetime products and iterating them as they go,
exactly,
a la old beta program.
Yep, exactly, right? Ron.
Yep. There is a deep, messy challenge there, and it's in the area that Google has historically not been good at, which is understanding when you want to share context and when you don't. So if you've got a bunch of a family is one situation, and even there are issues. But you've got a bunch of roommates, you don't necessarily want this one device in the middle of the house to have everyone's calendar and friends and things available to it, and let stuff leak back and forth between it. So there's a trickiness to making that work well. And as you say, voice recognition is one option, but it's still, you know, that's not, I wouldn't say that's reliable enough yet for you to trust it to unlock the device for you. And you want to say, you know, It would start needing to have to know who's around and who's there, and maybe that implies that it will have to have some way of knowing, you know, which phone is there and is it in the same location as the device or something like that? I can imagine it doing some clever stuff with the audio communication in the way the Chromecast did before between phone and Chromecast. So it could potentially realize that the person carrying this phone is the person currently talking to the microphone. But to some extent, that obviates the need for the microphone in the first place. So there's some oddness to it, and I suspect they're going to proceed cautiously and say, okay, if you want to set this up for a household, you should probably create an account for the household and give it access to the household calendar rather than it having everyone's individual calendar.
But that defeats the whole purpose of it. And I don't want to forget that Google has been recording all of our voice searches. You can access them all in your account dashboard. The phones have been, Android's been listening to us for how many years now? I really got to think that they're going to try to make it as frictionless as possible and not require the device and do that speech detection. And it might require you to say, okay, Google, my name is Ron. And then someone else in my house will say, okay, Google, my name is so-and-so. And so they pick up the different inflections and, will Google hear my Long Island accent and know it's me and then know Jason from his accent?
How much do you need? How much voice sample do you need for voice print recognition? Yeah.
Right.
That's tieable to the individual.
That's the big, it depends, isn't it? I mean, you need to have enough that you can distinguish them. So it has to be a reasonable amount. It's more than just an OK Google, I think.
That's what I'm asking. So if you had, let's say, four family members who each register their voices, OK Google would not necessarily be sufficient.
Right. I don't think so.
Mm. I mean,
so the inconvenience of having to say, "Hello, Google, I'm Ron. This is my voice print. Listen to me," would be redundant. Yeah, I got it.
I mean, unless Google comes up with some really clever secret sauce, I think you're probably hit the nail on the head, Kevin, with the idea of the phone that you might already have in your pocket somehow triangulating. And mind you, this is all speculation on whether this is even something that they're even thinking about.
That's what we do here.
We just all right. But that phone that's in your, I mean, because that's what Android, that's what Nearby is all about, right? Nearby is specifically created to detect when one Android device is near something else, via the API. And I could totally see them using
it. What about the kids, though?
Well, they may not have phones. Yeah.
Kids have access to my music library, I guess. Go ahead and play music. Just don't check my email, kids. Don't check my kids, you know what I mean? Like, it gets tricky.
But the kids are less likely to have their own calendar. And, part of the point of Google Now as was and whatever it's called now, Assistant, is that it has some understanding of what you've got going on, what you've done previously, where you're planning to be.
For sure.
So it can helpfully say there's traffic on the freeway, you should leave now type stuff to you. So it may be that it has to start a conversation with you. So you say, okay, Google, and you ask it a question, and it says, is that Kevin? And then you say, yeah, it's Kevin. It said, oh, well, as it's Kevin, you should definitely leave now because you're trying to get to San Francisco. Whereas if it was Andrew, then he's only trying to get to San Jose. So he's got some free time or whatever.
Yeah.
So but you'd have to have potentially have a negotation with it. But one of the interesting things.
Or out of nowhere, Kevin, it could just start talking to the room. Kevin, are you here, Kevin? You shouldn't be here, Kevin. You should be on your way, Kevin. If you're here, you're bad. You're going to be late, Kevin.
And then how are you going to pay for your internet bill anymore, Kevin? You're going to be late to work.
And I like the idea of having to negotiate with Google over your calendar, where Google's going to say, no, you should go. It's like, no, Google, I got 5 minutes. Don't worry, I know. It's like, no, you really should go.
Well, I get that because I go to San Francisco by bike and Caltrain. So Google thinks I want to bike there, so it gives me like 5 hours to get there. And it's like, no, I know it's a long way, but I can actually, I can actually bike to the train and then it speeds me up a bit.
Sometimes it's just a little too smart. So there was also a rumor or a post. It was a report. I can't remember which publication printed this, went with this last week, but it was about Apple's approach for the home appliance and the fact that they have a team dedicated right now, and they're testing hardware that would bring Siri into the home via an appliance of sorts. And the way that they were talking about, at least in those reports, about identification, user identification, would be facial recognition, which I don't know how that works. I don't know. Like you identify yourself by standing in front of the device and then you continue on. I don't know if that's the best approach, but that's another way to do it, I suppose.
Well, I mean, both Google and Apple shipped Face Unlock like years ago and then abandoned it because it was so unreliable.
Yeah.
I mean, it may still be buried in Android. It's disappeared from Mac OS. But Mac OS shipped that 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And no, they first put cameras on the top.
I mean, it's still a part of Android and smart in smart lock settings, and it's used in conjunction with the other ways that you protect your phone. So you can go in there and you can activate. I don't think it's called face unlock anymore, but it's, you know, it has to do with your face. And if you're on a lock screen and you look down at your phone, it's another way that you get access. You turn it on and it might not work 100% of the time, but you won't necessarily expect that it does, because you've got your other methods to get in. But when it does, it saves you even more time. It's kind of the way I think about it.
I mean, and the other thing is they have the Android Wear stuff that does this proximity unlocking thing. So maybe they're hoping that more of us will start picking up Android Wear devices, and that will work as the portable token.
Mm-hmm. I hope that's not their hopes and dreams are built on that, because I don't think that's necessarily going to happen. But I mean, and who knows? Maybe they come out with some little, you know, keychain or some little, you know, kind of tag, you know, to work with proximity and beacons to help to, you know, narrow it down. It doesn't have to be a full watch or things like that. And knowing Google, it's probably a combination of all these things we've discussed: voice recognition, proximity detection devices, all that stuff, all working together to make a great device that looks like an air freshener.
Right. Well, I mean, you could build a Wear device that was just like a fitness tracker without a screen, but that had, you know, the other bits and pieces that would enable those bits of it. It's componentized enough to do that.
Yeah. Other hardware: a $129 Google Wi-Fi router. So we have the On Hub, right? The big kind of bulky. It promises to do a lot.
Did everyone wondered why they even bothered making it?
Yeah,
it hasn't. I of course bought it like a fool, but my son's using it.
But also, why that doesn't have the microphones in? Why are these two products?
Yeah. Amen.
That's a good
question. So the new router is supposedly mesh. Do you think it'll outperform? What's the other one that everybody likes now that's expensive?
The Eero, is that what you're talking about?
Eero. So what's Eero, what's the price comparison?
That's a really great question. I can't remember how much Eero is, but I know it's more than $129 per. Now, I should also mention that Eero is a sponsor on the Twit Network, so just want to make sure that we get that out there. The big thing behind this is that, yes, you'd get the Wi-Fi router. I think the report that I read said that it's going to be like the size of an Echo Dot, so not a really large thing, you know, in comparison to the On Hub, which is this beast. In your house.
Why isn't the Google Home should also be a router upon which you can add other routers?
Yeah. Yeah. Should. PC Guy in chat says Eero is $500, possibly for three of them.
Oh,
three.
I see.
Okay. So you get like a kit, and Carson is thumbs up.
Oh, no, that's high math for me. What's 500 divided by 3? Oh, no. I feel like Howard Stern now.
Yeah, a little more than 125.
3 goes into the 5.
It's like 132
less than
2, or 133.
So it's
1.
Okay, thanks.
Something like that. So, I mean, per, that's actually right on point, right? If you were to get three of these routers. But so that would be nice to be able to, you know, bring internet to all points of my house. I know I need that. A 4K Chromecast that might actually be losing the Chrome logo. So they'd be going again, you know, a big part of what this seems like is Google's tackling this a little bit differently from a branding perspective. They're kind of doubling
down. They're so
down.
Confused on brands.
It's pretty confusing. It's like they went with Chrome because Chrome was recognizable, but now they're going with G from the Google because that's recognizable. You know, same reason, different outcome.
I think they went with Chrome because Chromecast came from the Chrome team. I think they branded these things back in the day just by the teams that worked on them, not by the consumer or branding point of view. Now, and again, going back to this event, it seems like they're trying to pull all this stuff in and have a cohesive brand presence to consumers to not confuse the heck out of them, which is probably a good idea, and they should have done years ago.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, because the Chromecast was like, you know, version 3, wasn't it? We had the Google TV, and then we had the Nexus Q, and then we had the Chromecast. So it was like three different teams had a stab at making something like the TV, and one of them won. And so now it's like, okay, that's the one that makes sense. Yeah. And the Google TV stuff has sort of vanished away as well.
Yeah, the Android TV stuff is still kind of around, kind of, sort of.
It's languishing, though, languishing.
Yeah, right. You don't see much about it at all.
But also, I mean, the combination of Chromecast and the Google Home thing make a lot of sense. I mean, that's the piece that's missing from the Amazon one, which is the ability to say, play this on the TV. Mm-hmm. and you know, direct this to the kitchen or the living room or whatever. And that was shown as part of the demo, and that's it's an obvious funny. Thing to do.
That's funny. And I even forgot about that, and I thought that was so cool when I saw it on there. So now I'm looking forward to it a little bit more. Because, yeah, that would be nice.
This may be a little off, but since we're talking about ridiculous failed Google products, Google Glass, would you guys use the Snap?
I wanted to make sure we talked about this while you were on, okay, by so the way.
Okay. I don't mean to raise it now.
Not at all.
Bring it in.
What do you think, Jeff?
I'm most interested about the Snap. So Snap, as everybody knows, has a round camera. To me, that makes sense because it's the I said at the time of Google Glass, I realized that they tried to put too much into one device.
Yeah.
There should be glasses that are a camera, period, full stop. Don't try to give you the experience. Don't try everything else. Don't try to give you notifications. So that's one, it makes sense to me that spectacles, as Kevin Marks put it, we made fun of him for this, that spectacles would have a camera. The second thing that fascinates me even more is the idea of the round image in two ways. One, TV started round. If you look at all old TVs, they had round picture tubes. And second, that the round image, because you can, the way the demo is, you can go any which way, it gets rid of the idea of vertical or horizontal. It doesn't matter how you look at it, can change your perspective. I mean, is round genius or is it the most ridiculous gimmick ever?
I think it's genius. I think a lot about this is actually taking the lessons learned from, you know, let's say the failed Google Glass. Google Glass as a consumer product, I would say failed. It might work in the enterprise, still, you know, waiting to see how that plans out. But they learned a lot of lessons here, right? They limited it down to just, I think one of the strengths of Google Glass was the camera. That was one of the things I was most happy with.
It's an obvious camera. Nobody can accuse you of spying on them. It sure is obvious.
It's obvious. There's a light on it. There's a light that tells them that they're being recorded. It doesn't record long, long form video. It keeps it cut to 10 to 30 seconds at the very longest.
I wish it also did photos.
That would be nice. Yeah, right. That would be nice. I'm surprised, actually, that it doesn't have the ability to do that, but...
You can pull a still out of it later. You know, it'll be like pick the still you want. It's like multi-shoot.
But it's simplicity.
The fascinating thing to me is that they've taken two things here. They've taken the thing that everyone was most worried about Google Glass about, which was people walking around with surveillance cameras on their faces, and made that front and center and made it the whole point of the device. So it's not that. So, that, you know, half of Google Glass was, I've actually got a little heads-up screen that's telling me what's going on, which, you know, probably does make more sense to watch, but that was the point of it. It was the thing in the corner of your eye, and then the camera thing was an augmented part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was an ambiguous thing to be wearing. You weren't sure if people were photographing you or not, even though it did have, it had a light on it and things. That was very much the perception of it. Mm-hmm. So here they're explicitly saying, no, this is a thing for photographing people, and they're taking, you know, I'm not sure, they haven't skydived out of a Zeppelin, but they've done their own, you know, cool kid version of that.
I have my spectacles coming out of the Zeppelin.
But the other thing, the round thing is actually quite subtle. What they've basically done there is they've taken Instagram's everything should be square thing, which Instagram has since backed away from, and taken that a stage further. So the everything must be square was Instagram's, first it was aping medium format, which was a square format, so it looked like a professional film thing. But also, it got away from the which way around do I have to hold my phone to take this photograph thing. And by taking that a stage further and say, well, if we assume that things are circular, then we can rotate the angle later and we can adjust which way it's pointing. That adds something as well. I'm intrigued to know if they have a geo model that they're recording with it as well, or if it is just
there an up and down or not? Right.
Now, is there a gyroscope?
Is it
there?
One camera or two?
It is two, right?
No, I believe it's one camera.
If it were two, back to your early discussion, Kevin, if it were two, it could do stereoscopic.
That's right. Nice. I thought it was two and it could do the stereoscopic thing, which would be
It's got two
cool.
images on it, but I didn't know if it was two cameras or not. It's got two round things on it.
Yes, it does have two round things on it. I thought it was just for symmetry, but I could be wrong on that. I hadn't seen anything about stereoscopic, but that would make it even more interesting, I think. You view that after the fact, but
you put your headset on. But also, having stereoscopic means that you can do the depth of field tricks that Apple has been touting.
Exactly.
And you know, Google, right, Google so here's their camera you know, 3 years ago, but you have to move the camera up and down to get the stereoscopic thing to make it work. So it's a pain in the ass to actually do.
Right.
Whereas if you've got two lenses shooting continuously, you can construct the depth map and do later on, you know, in post, you can say, you apply the filter to focus, pull it, or focus on that.
And then the app can do that because it'll have the standard distance. It'll know what's what.
Yes, exactly.
I, of course, will be pissed. I'll want it, but I'll be pissed because I'm nearly blind. And trying to get prescription lenses for that odd shape will be impossible. Plus, it won't be cool because it will be sunglasses.
Well, no, I think they look big enough to wear over glasses like you or I wear. I mean,
That's so dorky. That's
one of the Google glasses wearers.
That's what that's why I spent $2,000 also getting the prescription lenses for the Google effing glass.
It's okay. It's okay. We've all been there in some way, shape, or form.
Well, here's
a theory of why it's not going to work.
Okay.
That it will flop horribly. One reason. Selfie.
Doesn't do a selfie.
You said a great, great picture of Hillary Clinton with supporters, and everyone was turned around from her so they could all get a selfie with her.
That was amazing.
Right? And it was, oh, no, this is the world, the state of the world 2016. But the truth is, everybody wanted to be in the picture. And with Snap, you can't be in the picture.
That's a really good point, especially considering the force that Snapchat is behind it, which is like the default camera view when you open Snapchat is the front-facing camera. So
exactly.
So now what we need is the spectacle selfie stick.
You know what you need is a mirror. You hold a mirror out in front of you, and that's what you shoot.
Okay. That is a very interesting kind of angle on this because, selfies are a big deal right now. I think what Evan Spiegel, when he talked to the Wall Street Journal about this, a story that he brought up specifically, I think he went hiking in Big Sur the first time he went to test the spectacles, and when he got back to look at the footage, the realization that he made was that, you know, he's not watching video that he recorded, but rather he's revisiting a memory that he had. And, you know, I think in this case, that is the driving force behind this. Once somebody does that and experiences what that is like, I had that many times with Google Glass, and I'm sure Jeff and anyone else that's had Google Glass.
No, I just growled a lot.
Did you record video, though, and then look at it later and be like, oh, yeah, I remember that in that, you know, framed that way. I remember that in my life, but I'm watching it again.
The POV video is weird to me, though. I feel like I watching their video of people skateboarding and high-fiving at the pool and things like that. And I get it, Jason, when you talk about the context of your child taking its first steps for the first time or things like that. But I think video after video of you walking or running or at an event and a lot of motion and a lot of blur, I think that is going to get nauseating after a while. And it's going to be the kind of video I don't want to watch when people post.
Yeah.
But it fits with the Snapchat model.
Right.
You know, it's... And to some extent, it's going after Instagram because Instagram was the here's my observation of the world thing originally before it became more selfie focused, whereas Snapchat was take the photo, react to the photo, take the photo, react to the photo, back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming it's, you know, you're not going to put dispose of your phone when you get one of these things. So you can still take selfies that way. So I think it's gonna get a reasonable amount of traction. I think they've been very clever with positioning it as this sort of straightforward thing that you can add to the system. Because I think it is better than a selfie stick, certainly.
As I think about it, though, I'll make you a bet that the most common picture people will take when they buy it will be in front of a mirror so they can take a picture of themselves in them.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
I think you're right. Yeah, at least from the beginning. At least from the beginning,
everybody will have to do that to say, "Look, I have them." Right? We would all do that immediately
to prove that they're in on the game and they're in on the secret. And I think that's another part of why the circular video is a brilliant move. Right? You don't get that circular video when you use a phone. You only get it when you use the glasses. So everybody using the app, they see these really neat photos. Maybe they don't know about spectacles yet, but then they wonder, like, how the heck do I do that? Now they know how. They thought it was cool. Therefore, and it's accessible, right? It's $130. It's not $1,500.
Oh, hey,
so they can get through the door pretty easily.
So. I think the selfies in the mirror of people wearing these glasses will be hysterical. Because it's going to be Snapchat, so they're going to be all neon. They're going to be colorful. They're going to be stylish.
And
they're
going to look ridiculous. The first face you were going to see, Robert Scoble.
Yeah, probably.
Probably in a bathroom with a fogged mirror. Because it'll be in the shower.
Possibly so. Possibly so. I think maybe Scoble has learned a lesson or two since that fateful day. It's possible.
Can you back to your phone discussion? Could you simulate the round easily? Given current technology, could you do round video from a phone?
Sure. Sure.
Right?
Yeah. It's just
a matter of cropping, right?
Yeah.
So it'll be a gimmick that probably spreads for a while.
That's a good point. If it's easily replicable on a phone, there'll probably be app developers kind of jumping on the hype train and doing this.
The thing that's not clear from the promo stuff is that is this doing the kind of smoothing that Hyperlapse does? And if you know Hyperlapse, Instagram thing. So basically, what that does is it takes into account the gyroscope and the positioning stuff that the camera has to know what you're doing with the video, and then puts a low pass filter over it. So when you turn and move your head around with it and use it as a camera, you get like someone's using a Steadicam from it because it's damped the motion. And so if they've been smart enough to do that as well, then I think that will make a difference to how these things are perceived.
That would be.
But
nice.
they may have just gone for the full jerky verite thing with it.
Yeah. And that would address part of your concern, Ron, as far as throwing a camera on your face and living life isn't necessarily the best thing to look at after the fact because things jump around a lot. That was certainly the case with Google Glass. There wasn't any stabilization on that thing. So,
Well, no, they did it in post in YouTube. So if you put it up to YouTube, would put a little flag up and saying, "Hi, your camera's video is really wobbly. Shall we unwobble it for you?"
Yeah.
But that's not as it's guessing what to do in that case. Yeah. And it's not as reliable as actually having the data there.
And it would make things a little blurry and all that kind of stuff.
What's really neat, though, going back to the circular video, is at least on the website, on the spectacles.com website, the second screen, and you scroll down, is someone holding a phone and rotating the phone and the video doesn't move.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Which is crazy. I mean, it's cool. I mean, it's funny because Snapchat is the biggest, killer of the 16:9 aspect ratio widescreen photo video taking in the world. So it makes sense that they would take it one step further in this way, too.
Yeah. I mean, that right there, this is the thing that when users of Snapchat are thumbing through and they realize they can do this on an image, if they haven't heard about spectacles, they see this and they wonder, how do I do that? That's where all this stuff does, the hardware.
Right, this and 360 and 150 and VR and all that stuff, it breaks the filmmaker's control.
Yep.
Yes.
Oh, for sure. Right.
Which is what's fascinating about it to me. And in various ways. Sometimes you look behind, sometimes you don't need to, sometimes you can look around. It's really fascinating that this notion of the my whole control as the auteur was to say, here's the way you should look at this. No.
Mm-hmm. Well, and partly that's because you were like rationing pixels. You only had a certain amount of resolution, and you were working to do that. And so you were looking at a box on the screen, and you go around like that and decide which box you're looking through. And am I zooming in? Am I zooming out? And this does let you change that. And this is something we've discussed before: is that as we start shooting with cameras, that we can do that later. It also means that working and potentially give the end user control over that. The engine doesn't necessarily want the control of that, and how you start having to direct their attention is much more like staging a theater show where you've got to draw their cues into one place or another as the action happens.
That's interesting. So it becomes theater in the round, or it becomes a stage, or it becomes rethink theater. I was just talking about this with somebody about VR yesterday here.
Yes.
And thinking that we should bring in, even though it's fictional, we should bring in a theater person to think about how you put people in an environment and tell the story.
Absolutely. And that is part of it. And it's also, you can't really do a cut, because a cut lets you move from one shot to another, and you can do juxtaposition and montage, and that's the whole theory of cinema. But if you don't know where they're looking, you can't do a cut. So you have to make sure, you do something to make them look in the right place for your cut transitions to work. And there's people who've been interesting work with that, where they basically wait for you to be looking at a certain place, and then they can do the transition that they want to do to the next piece of footage or the next person coming in. So you have to basically, you're looking around the room or whatever. Then when you look to the door, that means that they can make the person come through the door because they know you will see them.
Right. Yeah, that's part of what Google has done with its kind of, I can't remember what they're calling it these days, but their immersive kind of storytelling is that they wait for that cue to happen. That bird flies by and you go, oh, I'll follow that bird. That takes you over and that plays the rest of the thing.
And that, that gets you out of the particular spherical space you're in or whatever.
Yeah. Or if there's smarts behind the scenes to know scene by scene the thing that you should be focused on, when it switches to the next scene, it takes wherever you happen to be looking and places the next scene perfectly.
Yes, but the trouble is that doesn't work as a montage. With a montage cut, you're very careful to cut so that the motion makes sense and you can process.
Yeah, no, okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
Whereas if you're you know, everything becomes a jump cut, which means you need a couple of seconds to make sense of it, and also your first reaction is to look around. If you basically teleport to a new location, your first reaction is to look around rather than to look at the thing that's been put in front of you.
Right.
So it's a very different grammar, as you say, Jeff, and it's going to take a bunch of work to make sense of it and make this stuff work. But maybe, you know, having lots of people with little cameras on their heads is going to help build a grammar up for this. Mm-hmm. If your Snapchat story becomes a series of you know, video montages as well as just stills, then that's they're going to be driving that grammar and creating it in the way that makes sense to people.
Mm-hmm. What an exciting time to be, you know, a filmmaker or a videographer, call it what you will. You can rethink the presumptions of the field now. I mean, it's scary too because it breaks the iambic pentameter that you had to work within.
But these opportunities don't come along very often in fields like this, right? Like, you don't have this potential shift in technology. We don't actually know where VR is heading, but right now it seems to be taking what we do know and have known for years and years and years and years and setting a new path for it. Will it be that, you know, that I don't know, that widely adopted down the line? Don't know, but that is opportunity for people who want to go in and, you know, solve those difficult challenges early on and establish.
The interesting thing too is that it requires the distribution piece, because if you can't get an audience, they can't see it. Yeah. So the fact that Facebook allows you to do 360,
right,
allows you to do live, and supports the Mevo 150 degree thing, and Snapchat supports the round thing. The distribution is key. It's not just that, you know, a new camera came out that can do something new. That's the least of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's also, it's an interesting moment in time, at least for Snapchat as an entity, because up to this point, it's been the millennial heavy use, you know, single moment kind of photo video sharing app, and it shows that they're planning for a next act. By changing the name of the company, moving, you know, developing a piece of hardware that they're going to manufacture and sell. And then now, as you point out, Jeff, you know, really be a distribution platform. There's going to be similar to how, you know, YouTube has spawned stars and there are people who are stars on Vine. You know, they're going to be
you're right, Ron. Yeah. GoPro too, right? GoPro became a kind of a content network because of its technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because of its hardware.
Yeah. Cool stuff. I'm not much of a Snapchat user, so that's the challenge. It's like, I want to check Jason. These out and everything, but I don't know. Yeah, I'm not using Snapchat, so it'll be kind of hard for me. I guess maybe that's the trick, right? People want it. They might not be using Snapchat yet, but now they are, because that's the thing.
That's what they're hoping for, I think.
That's what they're hoping for. Yeah.
Well, but there's also going to be a very limited number of these things, so you know that, you know, I could see Leo now hitting buy. You know, how we get our hands on this will be interesting.
Suddenly we have all of, you know, the halls of Twit will be filled with these glasses.
Because I imagine Snapchat knows who the influencers are. Snapchat, I'm guessing, will do invitations to buy.
Google did that. I remember when Google did that. Let's hope they learn some lessons from Google in that regard.
They already have with the light placement, so maybe that's just a sign of things to come.
Yeah, well, they learned a lot. Yeah, price, light placement, all that kind of stuff. How much longer do you have with us, Jeff?
I have about 15 minutes.
15 minutes? Okay. How about I'm going to take a quick break. I'm going to thank a sponsor, and then let's come back and let's talk a little bit about Google in India, because suddenly, I mean, we've heard about this a lot already, but suddenly, like in the last couple of days, Google has signaled very heavily that it is getting serious about the market in India. But before we talk about that, let's thank the sponsor of today's episode. That's the Ring Video Doorbell. I have one right here. I also happen to have one at my house, you come to my front door, you're going to find one of those bad boys there. You ring the doorbell, and I'm going to see you ringing the doorbell. That's what the Ring Video Doorbell is all about. It's about kind of protecting your home, giving you access to know who is there, who's ringing that bell, even when you're not there. There's a home burglary every 13 seconds. Most of those happen in broad daylight. And how does that get executed? Well, burglars will ring your doorbell, and they'll make sure that you're not there. And then once they realize that, they'll come in and break in and steal all your stuff. Ring Video Doorbell has been proven to stop burglaries before they happen. It's going to allow you to see and speak to anyone who approaches your door using the smartphone that you already have in your pocket. And now Ring is using their advanced motion detection technology to protect your entire property with their Ring of Security kits. Kits include a Ring Video Doorbell and may include a stick-up cam, a solar panel, a chime. I also have a chime in our house, and a solar security sign. Pro kits include a Slim Video Doorbell Pro. That's the new one with crystal clear 1080p HD video and night vision. It's also hardwired, so it never needs to charge. The wireless and weatherproof HD stick-up cam keeps an eye on other parts of your property. You can sprinkle them throughout. That's going to allow you to hear and speak to visitors with two-way talk. You can plug the chime into any standard power outlet inside to know when you have a visitor outside. Even if you left your phone upstairs, you're going to hear it in your living room thanks to the chime. The illuminated solar security sign deters intruders before they actually get to your door. They know that you're protected. The Ring Video Doorbell and stick-up cam install in just minutes. It really does not take very long. They give you all the tools that you need to do that. Working together, they provide 24/7 monitoring of your entire home, whether you're in the living room or if you happen to be thousands of miles away. And now you can connect your Ring Video Doorbell with your favorite smart locks and hubs for added convenience, monitoring, and security. Taking your smart home and make it even smarter. Really cool stuff. Highly recommend checking out the Ring Video Doorbell. You can join the millions of homeowners who protect their home with Ring. For limited time, This Week in Google listeners will get up to $150 off one of the Ring of Security kits. All you have to do is go to ring.com/twig. That's ring.com/TWIG to check it out for yourself. And we thank Ring for their support of This Week in Google and the Twit Network. All right, so number of things happened here in the last couple of days that are kind of signaling Google's continued focus on India. What's up, Ron?
Well, before you talk about continued focus on India, is this we totally skipped over the fact that Google is now a legal adult?
Oh,
all right.
I suppose we should pat Google on the back and say welcome to adulthood.
And maybe once you hit 18 years old, then you go abroad and you expand to India.
That's they're traveling.
Let's note this. Google can vote, and probably one vote from Google is worth about 3 billion votes. So you know who I want them to vote for.
Yeah. We know. Okay. 18th birthday. We don't actually know what day the birthday is on, though. They continue to celebrate it on the 27th, which was yesterday. Since 2006, they've done that. Before that, it landed on the 26th, then the 8th, then the 7th, if you keep going far back. So who the heck knows when the birthday actually is? But it's sometime this month, and they're 18 years old now.
So I got a call from Live 5 BBC, and they went, the impact of Google on society, right? So it's just this typical journalistic. They went after the tax story again and again and again. I said, this company has changed the world for the last 18 years, and that's all you want to concentrate on? I got pissed.
As you should. You're right.
Yeah, I said, I'm mad about this. I'm mad. The interview ended then.
Google has literally changed the entire landscape. You think about where we were in the late 90s with search and using Alta Vista and all these various things, and to see it's gone from a search engine to email to all these other tools to phones. I mean, honestly, looking back on it, I can't believe the amount of impact Google's had on my individual life, much as the world. So
changed my entire. I got a book out of it for one thing. changed my entire worldview. Changed my notion. It and blogging together changed my view. Of media and what media are. It changed our notion of getting facts in society, even though we don't always do it well. Changed whole industries. It's a big deal. It's a grown up. Yeah.
I mean, I think when you talk about cultural significance alone, I remember when I was in school, the lesson about when a brand eclipses its product and becomes part of the vernacular. And the example when I was in school, it was Xerox, like, oh, I'm going to make a Xerox. And now the example is I'm going to Google something.
You're going to Google something. Yep.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. Even when, my six-year-old daughter knows how to Google something with her voice. Like, that's this is the world that we live in, that a six-year-old has access to the world's information.
Yeah.
Wait until Google knows it's her and can answer her in a
Oh, sure. Here you go, Lucy. Here's the answer. So apparently Google turned 18, decided to go jet setting around the world, decided I'm going to go check out India and see what it's really like. I've always wanted to. Google, as I was saying, is very interested in India. They see, you know, they've been in the pursuit of the next billion users. It's part of why they did Android One. And I think they launched that in India a couple of years ago, their kind of low cost hardware effort. I don't know how successful that's really been for Google, but that was them trying to reach those next billion users. And a number of things happened this week involving India. First, they started Google Station. Well, I guess this has been going on for a while. Basically, it's a public Wi-Fi initiative where they're bringing, they say, fast Wi-Fi to everyone. And that is true. It's like, 40 megabits per second in some cases. Pretty crazy fast to these train stations. And what they've announced is that that's working really well in India. They've got 15,000 people getting online for the very first time every day using these hotspots throughout India. That's according to Google. So they want to expand that effort outside of India and bring it to more places all over the world so that they can, you know, get people to use their services. Because when you have internet access, you're more likely to use Google products.
And they won't get in trouble the way Facebook did with net neutrality by trying to give it to you on your phone. So it's not quite as powerful yet, mm-hmm. but it keeps them out of trouble.
Yeah, that's true. They can monetize with ads, with access fees if needed. But yeah, so they've got efforts there. They also announced, expansion of the YouTube catalog. So YouTube is a high bandwidth app. You use YouTube, you're going to be churning through a lot of data just to use YouTube, just the traditional app that we have. So they've released a new app called YouTube Go. It's targeting places like India to address those issues, data usage, language support, all that kind of stuff. It gives you all of these controls, all of these options for basically allowing you to operate YouTube in an offline state for the most part. We already have offline support in the YouTube app, but this is kind of going a step further. It's caching thumbnails, highly compressed thumbnails, when it has access to Wi-Fi so that when you're out on data, you can still kind of use YouTube to a certain degree. And even if you're not accessing data at that point, you still have things you can do with it. Offline video caching, if your connectivity goes away, it stops, so it's not going to churn through your data to finish playing that video. It's basically just super hyper focused on protecting users in these areas that would otherwise be paying through the teeth for that single video to play, because 200 megs for a video, that's insane, the cost behind that.
But that also makes a lot of sense when combined with the Google Station thing, where they're saying, okay, there's Wi-Fi in public places. So if you're standing there, you'll have a ability to cache that, and then when you get on the train, then you can watch the video there. So there's an interesting, synergy that they've got going there. In effect,
not only that, I mean, talking about synergy, they also announced features for Chrome for Android that are coming soon. Data saver improvements, basically a new download manager for doing things like saving sites, music, photos, videos, all of that for offline viewing.
And what works in India is going to work in Africa, is going to work in South America, is going to work in low bandwidth markets all over, and high cost markets all over. It's a really smart way to go, I think.
Yep. Agreed.
And when you just hear you rattling off all the functionality of it to work in low bandwidth, it makes me realize how dependent on high bandwidth I am. We've become now, just thinking about, like downloading websites for offline use and things like that. Like, geez, like the web is, I mean, all of this stuff is so not designed for low bandwidth access. And so it's great to see Google and Facebook has been doing this as well. And other, kind of big companies approaching these areas, because really that's where the growth has to come. We're all connected. You got to connect everybody else now.
Yeah. And that's, and I'm happy you went there, because it's the perfect transition. Ron Amadio at Ars Technica thinks that Allo, which, by the way, surpassed 1 million installs over the weekend, as well as Duo, are limited in the many ways that they are. And we talked about it a lot on last week's show. And I think since then, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about, like, why doesn't Allo do this list of things? You know, what is my reason for using it? Ron posits that is because Allo was not created for us.
I think it's a brilliant analysis. I think it's so smart.
It's spot sense. On that when he really smart. Breaks it down, it's created for markets like those in India, let's say. The split of those two apps signals that Google is targeting users of WhatsApp. Obviously, that's the world's most popular messaging app. 69% of Indian internet users are on WhatsApp as of 2014 Q4. Google even tried to buy WhatsApp in 2014, lost that to Facebook. So Google, you know, has had a mind in this. It's tied to a single device, no web client. That means that it's targeting the dominant computing device of users in these regions. Many times that's all they have. They have a mobile device. They don't have a desktop. And so that's just not a consideration. Allo launched in India before rolling out everywhere else. It was like the initial launch was India, which makes you, and then mind you, you know, talking about YouTube Go as an example, right? It doesn't support HD video. If YouTube Go as an app was marketed in the way that Allo seems to have been for everyone to use, everyone would have jumped onto that, right? Like, oh man, it's so feature limited. It doesn't, you know, give you HD video. But because it's not marketed towards us, I mean, of course we forgive it because that's not the app that we use. We use the full-fledged YouTube app. Why did Google do it differently with Allo? What do you guys think? Because, I mean, it really does seem like it was created for this other market, yet they're marketing it for everyone. Why?
Well, because they want to market it as for everyone because they know that anyone in India will be seeing that marketing. So to say they should have just sold it to India then it will be seen as, oh, this is something some patronizing thing Google has done just for us, mm-hmm. as opposed to this is the future of communication and we're getting it first, which is a much stronger message. The thing that's slightly unclear to me about this is very tightly bound to your SIM though, and a lot of Indian phones have dual SIMs so that you can migrate between things. So I wonder if they've actually thought that through. Will you find that if your phone switches one SIM to the other, it'll forget who you are and switch to the other one?
Ooh, it's like having an apps account, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that is, WhatsApp gets away with that. But, you know, WhatsApp has that same problem. One of the reasons I didn't like it was that if I went to the UK and switched SIMs, suddenly it didn't work anymore. Maybe they've thought that through and fixed that. But maybe you can bind more than one SIM to an account. But That may be an issue they will see as they roll it out.
Oh, they're already seeing it. That's been massive amounts of complaints about it, is that it's tied to the phone number. And not only is it tied to the phone number, but all the messages and everything are contained locally. So if you do switch to Allo on another device, your whole history is gone. Mm-hmm. I think that just speaks to the larger identity problem that we have in our online life. Whether you go by an email address or a phone number, how do I prove I am me? And then how do you protect from someone else pretending to be you? And it's a tough thing to figure out, and it shows that even Google can't figure it out. I don't know. I said it earlier in the show. I love the promise of Allo, and I love what they've done with Google Assistant. I think that's the real secret sauce. That's the magic. But as a app as total, whether or not it's been developed for a smaller market versus our market or not, who knows? But I just feel like the app is so early and it's half-baked.
I mean, also part of this is maybe that team's frustration with Google's core identity strategy being tied to email address, which it has been for years,
yep.
And they've been trying to fix that for a long time, and it hasn't worked its way through. So they're forcing the issue by breaking it.
Yeah,
I apologize, my friends, but I probably should go back to work.
Understand, Jeff.
This is fun. That's work.
You don't want to talk about media companies buying Twitter.
Well, I did ask. I was around a whole bunch of audience development people, and I said, "What company do you want to buy Twitter?" And somebody said that was a dumb question, which is fine. It was, but it was a little parlor game. And the discussion all went around Google. Google needs Live. The Google could really bring attention to this. They all kind of, I guess, were by their presumption, were hoping Google. Who do you wish buys Twitter?
Well, clearly from the TechCrunch article, we're looking at Salesforce as the best option.
Not sure I agree with that, but
Salesforce loves chat. Salesforce Don't forget, Salesforce is about customer relationships.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But what's interesting about all of these companies, especially Disney, can you imagine Disney having to deal with 4chan stuff?
Oh, geez.
Yeah, that seems like a tricky scenario right there.
Well, my other speculation is if Disney buys it, there'll be a movie and a franchise about the fail whale.
and then a live action movie.
There'll be a fail whale ride at Disneyland. You know, the fail whale falls and stops, and everybody's
introducing fail whale.
Yeah. But any of those companies is brand sensitive in a way that a company that's only Twitter is not. And what does that do to the free speech open platform with all of its problems and all of its benefits that it brings? Now, Google has Blogger, and it's stayed fairly open. But nobody ever goes to Blogger, so who notices?
Right.
Verizon, Salesforce, Disney. Who would best Microsoft. Advance and protect Twitter?
I don't know. I think that's the key right there. As a user, that's prime for me. That's my primary concern.
The advance and protect, yeah.
Whether Twitter feels like it needs to sell or not, mind you, they're investigating this because they have a fiduciary duty to do so. The board does. So it's hard to tell whether it's completely serious about it. I mean, I kind of feel like they're taking it pretty seriously, but they kind of have to at this point. But I don't know. I don't know of those options, which is the one that's going to kind of retain the charm of Twitter and not tear it apart and, use it for parts or change it so completely that it just loses its magic, its flair. I don't know.
What is the current cost? What is the market cap?
Market cap, $13.3
billion. That's a lot of money to buy for a bunch of yammerings.
Yeah. I mean, and sources were saying that Twitter could go for upwards of $30 billion potentially.
I don't think there's going to be that much bidding. Yeah.
Who's going to spend that much money on baggage? That?
But that was based on LinkedIn's price, wasn't it? That was where that number came from. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but Twitter brings as much back as 747.
Salesforce, yes, I can see the overlap with the marketing cloud and that stuff, but it's of the same order of magnitude size. That would be a tricky one to do. Google makes a little more sense if you think about YouTube rather than thinking about Blogger or Jaiku. Because YouTube, they did buy that kind of liability and free speech stuff.
You're very
and
right. That's a very good point, Kevin. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The piece that
makes sense that overlaps well is that Twitter has been doing a great job of this live video stuff. If you think about what they did with the debate on Monday and what they did with the Thursday night football stuff, they put a marker down to say, if you're doing live video and want to have an actual conversation about it, we can deliver that in the way that nobody else can. And I think that's probably why Disney would care. And maybe it's from the media people, and that may make sense for Google as well.
Yeah. Not to mention, Google has the money.
Disney makes sense. Disney makes sense too when you think about that as well, because Disney isn't just theme parks and cartoons. It's ABC, it's ESPN, it's Marvel, it's Star Wars.
I'm telling you, the fail whale. Yeah. All those places.
But in some ways, that may be a problem because at the moment, Twitter is neutral between the different networks and they can work with everyone. Whereas if they were owned by Disney or even Verizon, who owns a bunch of other channels, that could be problematic for them.
Hmm.
Yep. All right. I am on my way.
All right. Have fun. All right. Follow the arrow on your hat. See you, Jeff. Jeff Jarvis.
Sorry to be leaving, but always a pleasure to see you guys.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. It's great to see you. I'll see you next week.
See you, Jeff.
Have fun for the rest of your day at your event. All right. Take care. Good to have Jeff along, even if for just an hour-ish or so.
Always fun. Always fun.
What do we think about Twitter's kind of its current dedication to, I don't know, live media in the sense of, the NFL, Thursday night football, really kind of buckling down on that, which seems to be doing all right. I mean, it saw a 34% increase in audience from its first week, 327,000 viewers on average, 2.6 million reach worldwide. That pales in comparison to 50.5 million who watched the game on TV, but it's continuing to go upwards. Is that a good sign that Twitter's onto something, do you think? I mean, have either of you guys kind of checked out that offering?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that's come far too late to actually be happening. When you think about the impact that Twitter has had on the shared viewing experience, you know, we've seen the hashtag to the point of getting nauseating. You know, in the lower left corner where everything is hashtagged and all this sort of stuff. But if you think about it, people watch TV and they watch stuff that's going on, and then they immediately go to Twitter to see what other people are thinking about and to share their thoughts.
Yeah.
Merging those two things is a no-brainer. I'm surprised it's happening now. Like this is an example of what the problems of Twitter have been over the past couple of years, and it's really promising to see them shaking it out.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's right. I mean, the thing is that Twitter has been a savior for live TV and live video. You know, the only reason to watch things live is to experience them with other people, and Twitter has been doing that. You know, there's a reason this show has a chat room over there for people to talk about while we're doing it, even though a lot of people watch it later, because that gives a different experience, and that's Twitter is providing that in a broader way. And to some extent, you know, Twitch is an example of that. But Twitch is an example of that with a fairly narrow set of people, whereas Twitter is bringing this out to mainstream people, which is much more interesting. How much of the debate stuff did they pick up? Have they released figures on that, or has that not been announced yet? Because that was interesting on Monday night, seeing how much of Twitter was about the debate and the back and forth between the two, and even during the debate, citing tweets and so on as well.
I avoided Twitter like the plague during the debate. Sure many other people did.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to look it up. I had not looked for that. I mean, Monday night ranks as the most tweeted debate ever, for whatever that's worth.
Well, it was the most everything debate, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah, you watch really TV too.
Yeah, but I'm curious to know the numbers. How many people actually used Twitter as the source for streaming?
I don't think they've released it yet.
I'm not finding it.
Yeah.
I would imagine it probably beat NFL numbers, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Because it was a pretty significant event. Not that the NFL games are not to a certain segment,
I suspect, it probably was a way for people overseas to see the debate who would find it hard to see in other ways.
For sure. For sure.
I mean, it was on other media channels as well, but Twitter popping up and saying, "Do you want to watch this?" as it was starting was interesting.
Yep.
Yeah. Certainly. Yeah. That raises the awareness, because I think that's a challenge that they're going to face, and probably is the case with the NFL thing. Is like, how many people actually really know that they could go to Twitter and watch that game using the interface? It's just not something you, at least up until recently, think of Twitter as being the place to go do that at. And so they're raising the awareness on that, and hopefully that continues, because I really like the product. And yeah, like you said, Ron, kind of a no-brainer when you see them working kind of side by side. The main challenge that I see is that it gets a little noisy, right? Like you've got your tweets on one side, and you've got your video of the event that's happening on the other. But the tweets, really, it's just like everybody that's on that hashtag topic. And yeah. That gets really noisy really fast. It would be nice to have like a curated kind of like follow these experts, let's say,
right,
on the game or whatever.
Right. Which isn't, if you have, if you go there and you have a substantial number of people you're following, call out the people that you're following that are commenting on it. That would be interesting.
Yeah.
But relevant tweets. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like people who you're interested in. Yeah.
But the other part of that is that they announced that it's going to be easier for people to create moments. So that may well be fit together with that. If I can say, there's a moment around the debate. And then there's the moment about the debate curated by Twit, because Twit is talking about the tech aspects of the debate. I could follow that one. Mm-hmm. So that kind of thing could be interesting. So I suspect there's other shoes waiting to drop there. And they're working this out as they go. But it makes sense to me as the challenge is always, is there anything there at all? And most of the time when there's a live stream, there isn't anything there at all. And you're sitting there watching like an empty hashtag. And Twitter seems to have crossed over from that to the other problem of there's so much here, I'm not sure which bit to watch, which is a much more interesting problem to have.
Yeah, that started rolling out today, by the way. So any user can basically create moments only on the web client of Twitter. I really like moments. It took me a long time to understand it. I mean, understand why I would use it. But then I realize now, like the reason that I use it is because I have large swaths of my time when I'm at home where I don't have my phone on me, and I do that purposefully so I can focus on life. And it's really nice to pick up the phone, go into moments, and see what I missed on certain things for some reason. And not to mention, I also cut the cut the cable a couple of months ago. And so I don't know, for some reason it kind of fills that void. Are you guys, have you played around much with Moments? Do you think it's a really good feature for Twitter, or what do you think?
I don't use it that much, but that's partly because I spend a lot of time on Twitter anyway. So anything that's in a moment, I've probably already seen.
For sure.
It makes much more sense in the case you talk about, where I've been away and what's happened since I've been away. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, for me, it's like, oh, yeah, there's a moment about the debate. Sure, I'm watching that anyway, because I'm wired into Twitter. So I suspect it's not for me. It's for the people who Twitter is trying to increase their Twitter usage, increase their habits of it.
Right, right.
Yeah, and that's interesting, because like I realize that the majority of my Twitter usage is on third-party apps. You know, on my desktop, I'm using TweetDeck, not the website. Right. On my phone, I'm using Talon, not the Twitter app, right? So it's not...
So you're even though, right.
Yeah. So like I'm an old Twitter, you know, user who remembers when third party apps actually added value. And even though TweetDeck is owned by Twitter, it still feels like an independent entity. But at the moment, with this new chain rollout to Moments, I think I'm gonna be tuning in a little more just to check it out, because it's exciting. I mean, I think that you know I've wondered for a long time how Twitter is gonna evolve past what it's been. And it's funny, because you know I was listening to another podcast where the commentator was saying, you know, despite all of its problems and over the the past 10 years of Twitter being around, everyone complaining, we're all still there. So clearly there's something that attracts us to it. And now it's Twitter's job to, you know, give us back that value in return.
Yep. How about BlackBerry? Got some news today on BlackBerry, right? This is, and I hate to say that we saw it coming, but no, we kind of saw it coming. BlackBerry announced during today's earnings report that it is exiting the hardware business. Instead, it's going to rely on partnerships to create future phones. Now, this is not a complete surprise. BlackBerry CEO John Chen had said that this September would be kind of the deadline for the company to really kind of turn things around. It focused on Android with the Priv, and then later with the DTEC 50, and maybe one other phone that I can't remember right now. But they had little to no impact in a major way. The move to Android just kind of felt like too little, too late, I would say. Either of you surprised or sad? Even sad, because BlackBerry is a hardware force in the smartphone world. They were it
not
for
anymore.
A really long
they were.
Time.
Not anymore.
Yeah, not it's, sad. You know, shedding no tears, Ron.
No tears. I never liked BlackBerry to begin with. So I mean, but yeah, I wasn't surprised by this at all. And I mean, I feel bad for everyone at BlackBerry, because they got to figure out how to reinvent themselves. And I guess this is the approach. But, you know, not making hardware will sure save them a lot of money. So,
So basically, right now, they're going to focus more of their efforts on services, on their software, and hope that that's the successful moneymaker. But they're still going to be, so there will still be BlackBerry devices. It's just they're going to be created. Much like the DTEC 50 was. Apparently that was built by Alcatel and based on an Alcatel phone for the most part, the design of that. So that was kind of like a signal of things to come, essentially.
They're going to license the name. I mean, that's, you know, like, they'll partner with people much like Google does or has done. So, you know, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. And they've opened up their software to all Android devices. They just, you know, a couple of weeks ago opened up their software suite. So that you can use their services. I don't know how much that's moving the needle for the company, but that seems to be their focus going forward. We'll see about that.
No, it is one of those anticlimactic announcements where everyone says, wait, they were still making phones? You know, it's, which is kind of sad, but it's, you know, they basically missed the opportunity to do to fully embrace the Android thing and become a great maker of Android phones with a very specific niche. And by the time they got around to doing that, it was kind of too late.
Exactly. Too little, too late. That's the story of BlackBerry in this day and age. Galaxy Note 7 users are receiving their replacement units. Mine actually should deliver today by 8 p.m., I'm told, via the email that I got. Some people are saying that there are battery issues with those replacements. Not in the same way, though. Not like explosions or, you know, combustion or anything like that. In the sense that there's accelerated battery drain, issues with charging. In one case, it was a 10% charge overnight, and it discharged almost 45% in like 39 minutes. I don't know if that's an isolated incident. Because you know, weird random things happen like that.
Yeah. And
right now, and Samsung.
Just you're looking now. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. If you're looking hard enough, you'll find it. And right now, Samsung is so under the microscope. Right. Like any bad thing that ever happens to a Samsung device right now, everybody's going to report about it because it's such a clickable thing.
Well, might it also be related to the patches they shipped out to make it not charge as much for the previous ones?
That's I wondered about that. I mean, the difference here is that these are the replacement phones, so those shouldn't have that patch, right? Those should not be affected by that because they don't have the battery issues. And if Samsung went ahead and did that, then they really shouldn't have done that because that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But, you know, who knows? I mean, if this is a widespread thing, and maybe over the next week or two, we'll figure out if it's actually bigger than just small incidences. But if it's a widespread thing, that's just even worse for Samsung, man. Kind of feel bad.
Not good times at Samsung. Yeah, it's sad. I saw that crazy figure that it was like, what, 90% of the people return the Samsung Note 7 are going to buy iPhones?
No. It's the other one. It's the other way. 90%. Well, Samsung says 90% of the people who are returning them are getting another Note 7.
Oh, okay. I saw the opposite of that, that they were defecting to iPhones, but I forget what the source was on that. But yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, that's
but
good.
That's coming from Samsung. Maybe Samsung has a vested interest in saying, no, everything's okay. Don't look over here. And they're also pushing out a mandatory system update to remaining recalled devices. They're saying that 60% of the unsafe devices have been exchanged. So that leaves, obviously, 40%. I'm good at math. And they're going to send out a mandatory system update to those remaining devices that will nag the user at startup, at shutdown, and every 3 hours to trade in that phone. They say they're not going to be happy until 100% of the phones are traded in. So that nag would probably be pretty effective if it was coming every 3 hours. I know I would buckle down and do it eventually. What else? Space? You guys want to talk about space a little bit before we get to tips and all that kind of stuff?
Are we going to go to Mars, Jason?
Yeah, we're going to get our beep to Mars. quoting Arnold Schwarzenegger from Total Recall, of course. So let's see here. Elon Musk had his he has a plan. Making humans a multiplanetary species is what he unveiled yesterday. Basically dove into how SpaceX is going to get humans to Mars in droves. He says they're aiming for 1 million humans. Could be 1 million humans on Mars by 2060. So wait a minute. There's going to be 1 million humans on Mars in my lifetime. Is that true? I don't know whether to believe that or not. That seems lofty to me. But I don't know. What did you think of the announcement? It was very dense with information.
What I like about Elon Musk in these announcements is that it's like living in a Neal Stephenson novel. and for me, that's fiction. But for him, this is reality. Yes. And that's exciting. I'm totally excited by that prospect.
Mm-hmm.
I thought his idea of managing expectations is saying this won't work for interstellar transportation. Like, okay, it'll work for other planets, all the planets in the solar system. And it's like, oh, interesting ambition. And, you know, he didn't really have answers for the sort of the hard questions of how do you actually cope with radiation, especially on Mars where there's no magnetosphere and things like that. He said, oh, we can make artificial magnetic fields and things. So there was a certain amount of hand-waving in that part of it. But the physics of making a rocket big enough and be able to transport stuff did make some sense. But there's a lot of like, oh, yes, and be able to make fuel on Mars because there's plenty of water, which implies that they're going to go and land on the pole and take the ice cap off it. So it's, you know, it was definitely fascinating and interesting set of ambitions and, you know, intriguing thing to lay out. But I'm not really sure how many people are going to want to spend $500,000 to potentially go to Mars and die there. He may get more takers than I think, but that's interesting.
He definitely will. I already know people who would sign up instantly. You know, like that's no brainer.
I mean, it's you know, it's not inexpensive. Musk says right now, traditionally, the cost would be about $10 billion per person to get one person onto Mars. He's looking at targeting around $200,000 a person. Eventually, potentially lowering that to $100,000 a person. So even when you get to that lowered amount. This is no chump change. I mean, this is you're paying a lot of money so you can go and die on Mars.
Hey, but if you're gonna go somewhere, might as well go on Mars.
I suppose so. And the plan really hinges on something that SpaceX has been putting a lot of time and development into lately, and demonstrating successfully that they've kind of figured some things out on reusable components, right. Reusable rockets, being able to re-land something after launching into space, because that becomes the biggest, one of the biggest costs is we throw these things up there and it's a one-use scenario, and then we have to start from scratch and all that cost, that goes into it. This way, this lowers the cost because you reuse these a select number of times, of course, but that makes it at least a little bit more achievable.
Right. And his analogy with airliners made sense there, where he said, well, if we had to dispose of the airliner after each journey, then flying to New York would cost you $20,000. So $200,000.
Yeah, right. Yep. Right. Anything else? Anything else that you're burning to talk about before we get into the tips and all that end of show stuff?
Looking through the list, I think we covered most things.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot in here. There always is. But we've stuck pretty close to Google. We were probably about half and half, but I think those are the big stories. Why don't we do the tips then? Ron, we talked a Android TV came up briefly earlier.
We touched on it briefly earlier, and this is something near and dear to my heart, and I didn't mention it when that part of the discussion, because saving it for this.
Yeah.
But I love the Google TV. Android TV is something that I haven't had much chance to play with. And the Nexus Player, when that came out, got not so great reviews. It didn't sell very well. And, Google has shelved that product. So a lot of people are wondering, if I want Android TV, what can I get? Well, the Xiaomi Mi Box is something that's been promised to be available for a low price. And this past weekend, actually, one of our All About Android audience members tweeted a photo of the Xiaomi Mi Box for sale in Walmart. Photo of it on the shelf for $69. There it is in the real world. And the tech media picked up and ran with it from that Twitter conversation, which there's another value of Twitter.
I know.
But, so if you're looking for an Android TV experience for a low cost, if you don't want to do a Chromecast, this Mi Box looks to be a pretty cool device. I haven't got a chance to get my hands on one yet, but for $70, it's worth picking up and playing with. So that's my pick.
Especially when you consider that the Chromecast Ultra, which is rumored for next week's event, is also $69. And that's Chromecast. Android TV has cast capability built into it. So if you're going to pay for one, you might as well pay for the other and get more, right?
Yeah.
unless we're missing something significant about Chromecast Ultra that this wouldn't have. But I saw this. I actually got to pick up and kind of examine this this box at Google I/O. And I mean, it looks like a set-top box, basically, with the remote and everything like that. But pretty nifty. And even after this, people have gone into Walmart and found them on the shelves. Strangely, when they take them to the register to buy them, the register doesn't allow them to buy them. It says, "Oh, actually, we can't sell this to you because there's, they made up there's a defect or whatever." So they're getting some sort of error message, and part of that is probably just the fact that Xiaomi has not actually officially released this yet. So maybe they're prevented from doing so.
Fascinating how that happens.
Weird that it ended up on the shelf in the first place. But I would certainly seize that opportunity to get it, knowing that it's unreleased. Kevin, how about you? What you got?
Well, my usual thing is indieweb.org and Homebrew Website Club. So I mentioned that. There isn't one this week, but next week there's Homebrew Website Club in various places around the US and overseas. So look up that. If you want your own website, come along. We've definitely be one in San Francisco, and probably ones in Brighton and Portland as well. The other thing that was fascinating for me this week was something that Mozilla has made called A-Frame at aframe.io. So what this is, it's a way for you to make VR experiences by writing little web pages. So there's a whole series of demos of these that you can click through, and each one has a little button you can press, and it'll put it into the form you can look at it through with Carboid. But the point is that it's basically declarative web stuff. So it's like VRML for the 21st century. You basically say, I want a cube, I want a sphere, I want a texture map with stuff on top of it, and it creates a thing like that. And if you look at it on your phone, as you tilt the phone, the things move around. And if you put it in the cardboard, then the cardboard thing moves around. So you get a set of these. It's basically sort of construct 3D models very quickly and declaratively as if you're making a web page. So that's kind of fun, and I'm intrigued to see what people do with that.
Man, so this is kind of envisioning a future, possibly not very far off into the future where the internet is accessible in VR, where at least it's attentive to the needs of VR users and programmed around those needs, right?
But that's the idea, yeah. And the question, you know, the question with all these things is, well, what would you use that for? And right. If I'm basically making static scenes, what would they be good for? But that's why you build toolkits and see what people could make.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the same kind of thinking behind something like HTML5, which was like, why, you know, 10 years ago, envisioning an internet where we have application class websites.
Yes.
And, you know, that seemed like crazy talk probably back then. But now it's just kind of the norm because of technologies like HTML5 right. and others. So
it's basically adding a few new primitives to HTML, like I've got a panorama primitive and I've got 3D objects inside my panorama stuff.
Oh, wow,
and so,
cool.
So there's stuff you can do with that. And the question is, you know, what will people make up for it?
Right.
I'm intrigued to see, but it's... I was, you know, at the moment, the way you do this is with WebGL, which is a fairly low level API.
Yeah.
And so this is an interesting way of wrapping that up in a much higher level API that lets you just say insert sphere, insert square, insert panorama.
That's really cool. I'm excited to see what comes out of that. That's really neat.
Very neat. Very cool.
Mine is, I mean, we've all heard of Google Translate. Google Translate is really awesome. Got a big update that actually brings Chinese into the app. And they're using, man, such a big theme this year, particularly. I mean, VR is one of the themes that we've seen time and time again, story after story, is neural networks, artificial intelligence. And basically, Google is using its neural machine translation to both improve traditional translation that it's been doing, and as well as kind of bring Chinese translation into the app and into the application. Neural translation using Google's neural machine translation engine actually has reduced errors by 60%. So this app just becomes more and more of a beast. They're kind of, I don't know if you ever hit 100% necessarily as far as, you know, the type of translation you can get in an app based on these neural networks versus what a human can do sitting down and really understanding the intricacies of the language, maybe eventually, but we're getting closer. And that is just a really crazy, cool concept to me. I love the fact that we don't even need to know how to speak somebody's language, but we can still communicate with them. And in this case, you know, so much of that is built on the shoulders of neural networks behind the scenes. Crazy stuff. I wonder if we're doing the cool stuff that we're doing right now with neural networks and artificial intelligence, and it's building so fast. Like, I feel like this progression is happening so quickly where suddenly it's everybody's priority immediately to do this. It just makes me wonder what 5 years from now, what is that progress to? All of that focus on neural networks.
Well, that combined with the voice stuff they showed a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah,
Where they got much better voice synthesis within Neuronex as well. Yes. That was crossing the uncanny valley to
completely.
That. Well, completely. Except for the bits where they just gave it no input and it said really strange stuff on its own. That was spooky as hell.
But it sounded like someone just sitting there speaking gibberish.
Yeah, but I think the combination of those two and the combination of the neural net for recognition does mean that we're going to get a bunch of very interesting stuff that ties in with this. You know, that joins all these dots up. So being able to translate stuff from other languages, that, you know, if you think about the Google India case that we talked about earlier, that's a very strong case because there are lots of languages in India.
Mm-hmm.
There, you know, we're used to Indian people speaking English because that's an official language and it's what the governing class is used to. But actually, India has several hundred languages and translating between them has been historically been difficult. So that's a fascinating case again.
Yeah, and that was actually one thing that we missed when we were talking about India is, God, where was it? It's, I think, the Google Assistant, Hindi is the first language outside of English that Google Assistant has been created for. It's yet another kind of glimpse into Google's
Hindi,
kind of... Hindi.
You're building a case, Jason. I see it.
Sorry. Yeah, see, I need the app, apparently. Yeah, Hindi. My apologies. They're going to have support for that by the end of the year, and it's only the second supported language behind English, so that's pretty significant. Right. So,
and they also have Indian English as a dialect of English, along with American English, British English, and Indian English as a first-class language trained scope. So definitely something they're paying strong attention to.
Yeah, for sure.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool. It really does. That is it. This Week in Google is coming to a close. Kevin Marks, real pleasure, real treat to get to do this show with you. Tell people where they can kind of follow all the awesome work you're doing online.
The easiest way is kevinmarks.com. I'm also Kevin Marks on Twitter and Kevin Marks on Facebook and Kevin Marks basically anywhere. Everyone else called Kevin Marks is kind of crossed with me because I've got the namespace first.
You got there first. I mean, that's how the rules are played. That's how the game is played. Thank you again, Kevin. Really appreciate it.
Cheers. Great to talk to you.
And Ron, well, I think I normally know, but I will ask anyways. What about you? Where can people follow you, Ron Richards?
Sure. So I didn't get the namespace Ron Richards early on. I wasn't smart enough, but you can go to about.me/RonXO, and that's my handle. You can follow me on Twitter at RonXO there, and I'm pretty easy to find on the web. Every Tuesday, Jason, you and I are there doing All About Android, and I will be back next Tuesday, not only for All About Android, but to cover the Google announcement live special, as well as I'm going to join you for TNT, right? So it's going to be a packed day.
Yeah, very packed day. Next Tuesday, October 4th, is the day of the Google hardware event in the morning. Oh, wow. I believe it starts at 10 a.m. Pacific. Ron Richards, myself, and Stacey Higginbotham, who was out this week, obviously. She'll be back on Twig next week. We'll all be on hand to cover the event. So we're going to be doing that in the morning. And then Ron's going to join me on TNT because I think Megan's out that day. And we're going to talk about the event there. And then that night, we've got All About Android. We're going to talk about the event there. The next day, we're going to talk about the event on This Week in Google. By the time we get to This Week in Google, we are going to be experts.
You know everything.
Everything. All pieces, hopefully.
My dog is all excited about it. So.
All right. Yeah, I can tell. He's getting really excited about the hardware event. All right. Well, I will let you guys go. Thank you so much. You can find me. Well, I'm on Twit all the time. You can find me on Tech News Today, All About Android, Android App Arena, and this show again next week. And then following week, Leo Laporte will be back. This Week in Google records live every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, 20 o'clock UTC. How about that? And you can always catch it live at twit.tv/live. But if you want to catch on-demand episodes, back episodes, anything you might have missed, you just have to go to twit.tv/TWIG. That'll take you right there so you don't miss another episode of the show. I'm Jason Howell. Thanks for letting me take over the show for a couple of hours today. And we'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye, everyone.